Today is Thursday, June 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, is the U.S. Justice Department struggling to make decisions without fear or favor? Testimony from a federal prosecutor.
What I saw was that Roger Stone was being treated differently from every other defendant. He received breaks that are, in my experience, unheard of.
The U.S. sees its second largest rise in new coronavirus cases since the crisis began. Also ahead, the Rolling Stones release a new song that resonates with the times we're living in. It's all on today's International Edition. Despite mass demonstrations and demands for police reform following the deaths of African Americans like Rayshard Brooks, George Floyd, and Breonna Taylor, efforts by Congress to respond to the crisis stalled out on Wednesday. Democrats blocked a Republican-drafted bill as both sides blamed the other for the failure to make progress. Joining us to understand what happened is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, I understand that Tim Scott says Democrats were just not willing to compromise.
That's right. So it was a bit of a stumbling block Wednesday on Capitol Hill when the first chamber to take up the issue of police reform, the U.S. Senate, taking a look at Senator Tim Scott's Republican proposal, actually really wasn't able to advance all that far on it because Democrats decided to use a procedural block to not even get to debate on the bill itself. So afterwards, there was a lot of frustration on Capitol Hill, a sense that they really are running out of time. They don't have that many weeks until the Independence Day holiday break. And then, of course, Congress goes on another break for the whole month of August and into September. So what we're really talking about is just a handful of days left to really tackle a controversial set of issues in this country. And of course, one that has sparked nationwide protests for several weeks. This is something that Democrats and Republicans really aren't seeing eye to eye on. And there's really not a clear path forward for them.
What are some of the issues that Democrats were concerned about enough to block this? I heard Republican Senator Tim Scott saying there was no reason why there couldn't have been compromise, but Democrats chose instead to just block. What did they take issue with?
Well, Chuck Schumer and Senate Democrats sent a letter Tuesday to Senate Republicans listing what they felt was wrong with the Republican proposal. Namely, it was the way that Republicans are approaching the issue of police transparency and accountability. Democrats want to see a more robust system of reporting. They're also really tussling on this issue of no-knock warrants and chokeholds. Democrats say that the Republican proposal does not do enough to stop those two practices nationwide. Now, Senator Tim Scott took to the Senate floor after that measure failed and said, you know, look, there's nothing that lawmakers can do on the federal level to completely ban that practice. So he accused Democrats of being a little bit disingenuous when they were saying that his proposal didn't address this issue. He has some measures in his legislation that would encourage better practices around those approaches. So what you're really getting here, if you take a step back, is a lot of politicking from both sides who really want to take ownership of this issue. Republicans saying that Democrats aren't really invested in seeing bipartisan cooperation because, quite frankly, it wouldn't benefit them in an election year. Remember that a third of the U.S. Senate is up for re-election in just a few months. And then over on the House side, the entire U.S. House of Representatives is running for re-election too. Nobody wants to see an option where they actually all work together this close to the election.
So what I'm hearing is as much as the public demonstrations continue to cry out for some sort of change, some sort of reform, the likelihood of that happening is pretty slim for now.
When Senate Democrats voted to block this Republican proposal, they proposed a way forward. They said, look, let's start this as a bipartisan process in committee. This bill was not drafted in a committee. It went straight to this floor vote. They're giving Republicans a little bit of an olive branch and saying, well, look, let's start the negotiations from the ground up in committee, and then let's go from there. But as I said, they're running out of days that they're able to do that. And quite frankly, it really doesn't benefit anybody to appear to be working with the other side at this point.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Well, during a joint news conference with the visiting president of Poland, President Donald Trump on Wednesday responded, saying Democrats are trying to weaken American law enforcement.
They want to take away a lot of the strength from our police and from law enforcement generally, and we can't live with that. We can't live with that. This is a great bill.
The police officer who shot Rayshard Brooks in the back as he ran away was charged with 11 criminal complaints, including felony murder, just days after it happened. But could the charges against that police officer who shot Brooks in the back be a rush to judgment, given the current political climate in the U.S.? Joining us now is Jason Johnson, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, which is supporting the former officer. Thank you so much for being with us. You believe that this was a rush to judgment and the officer actually acted appropriately under the circumstances he was given. Tell us why.
Obviously, you know, the world watched with horror and disgust at the killing of George Floyd, which was in vivid relief on video, inexcusable, inexplainable. Whether you're a police officer with 30 years experience or you're a civilian who knows nothing about police work, it was apparent that what happened there was wrong and was a crime. But unfortunately, when people see that, I think they start to extrapolate or they start to make presumptions about other police encounters, high profile uses of force that are on videotape or aren't on videotape. And a good example of that, the shooting death of Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta, which also was captured on videotape and is dramatic and is difficult to watch, as almost all police uses of force are difficult to watch. But this one, in reality, is objectively reasonable. This was a situation where Mr. Brooks, even though he had been completely cooperative for 40 minutes with the police and the police had treated him with professionalism and respect, when he was told he was under arrest, he started violently resisting and assaulting police officers, even disarming one of their taser. And then he fled, and with a police officer following close behind, he turns with the taser in his hand and points it at the officer and discharges the taser. You know, there are a number of different explanations for why a police officer in that position would objectively fear for their life, and that seems to be what happened here. But we don't know the full picture yet because the investigation that was underway was basically disregarded by the district attorney, who made a decision to charge without the benefit of the investigation. And it lies in stark contrast to the George Floyd case, where there was an investigation. There was even a hesitancy on the part of the district attorney to bring criminal charges without a full investigation, even though in that scenario, the investigation was a little bit less important than in this Brooks case in Atlanta.
Police have come under a lot of scrutiny, obviously, lately. People in this case were basically saying this man was sleeping in his car after falling asleep drunk, and that he really wasn't posing a threat to anyone, and that because he was cooperative, that it didn't have to escalate to the degree that it did.
It's very common for observers of police behavior to draw some conclusion from the initial contact or the reason for the initial contact, and then look at the end result and say, well, driving drunk should never end with a person being shot and killed by the police. But it's really not important how the contact started. It did start from a call for service in which Mr. Brooks was alleged by the Wendy's manager to be passed out in the car. And then that led Officer Roth to the scene, caused him to undertake an investigation and determine that Mr. Brooks had been driving while intoxicated, which is against the law. It still subjects you to arrest. Officer Roth was doing what he's been trained to do, what he's developed an expertise at. He did so professionally with courtesy, didn't use any force whatsoever on Mr. Brooks until Mr. Brooks began violently resisting. And so it really doesn't matter how the contact started. The contact ended with Mr. Brooks presenting a real threat, an imminent threat to Officer Roth, and he responded accordingly.
What do you say to Mr. Brooks's defenders that say he was scared? He was scared. He had, you know, been drinking, and given what's been happening across the country as far as these protests and the concerns that African Americans have been raising about feeling like they're being profiled as dangerous, that he feared the police arresting him. him and potentially hurting him. So that's why he ran.
It's very likely that that's true. He could have been afraid for a couple of reasons. One, he could be afraid because he's on parole and concerned he was going to go back to prison. And he could be afraid. From what I understand, he had been following closely the George Floyd case, probably had seen that video many, many times. And based on the sensationalism around the George Floyd killing, he may have believed that that's actually commonplace for particularly white police officers to intentionally murder African Americans. But the facts are that's really not true. And it's unfortunate that he may have been led to believe that, and that may have influenced his decision to violently resist. But that doesn't change the actions taken by Officer Rolfe. I think it is a sad commentary that someone may be led to believe by sensational media coverage and a reaction to what genuinely was an anomaly. The killing of George Floyd, as tragic as it is an anomaly. And if you look at all of the statistics around police use of force, studies about police bias and whether police make different use of force decisions based on the race of the person being arrested, you can only come to one conclusion, that while police brutality does exist, and while there are police officers who have biases and frankly who are racist, the problem as it's described today in 2020 is nowhere near in the proportion that you would be led to believe by following the media coverage. So my reaction would be, it's tragic that Mr. Brooks is dead. I'm sure that anyone involved wishes that's not what happened. But it's a little bit more complex than to say, well, he was afraid, so therefore the way the incident ended was the police officer's fault, criminal fault. And that really is what this boils down to. It can be very tragic, and it is very tragic, that Mr. Brooks didn't survive that encounter. But that doesn't mean that what the police officer did was criminal or even wrong.
But now he has been charged with 11 counts, including felony murder.
We're seeing this trend across the country. Look at these cases on their own individual merit. You can't conflate the facts from one appalling and disturbing instance of gross police excessive force and murder, and then assume that every time police use force, they do so in an excessive or in a racially discriminatory way. They each have to be evaluated on their own merits and in no other way.
Jason Johnson, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, thank you for being with us. A federal appeals court Wednesday ordered the dismissal of a criminal case against President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, turning back efforts by a judge to scrutinize the Justice Department's extraordinary decision to drop the prosecution. Meanwhile, Attorney General Bill Barr Wednesday agreed to testify next month before the House Judiciary Committee. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The announcement came as the panel opened a hearing on Barr's actions as America's top law enforcement officer. Career Justice Department Prosecutor Aaron Zelinsky testified Trump ally Roger Stone was given special treatment before his sentencing.
He received breaks that are, in my experience, unheard of.
Panel Chair Gerald Nadler says it's clear Barr's not interested in justice, but rather in protecting his boss.
He's the president's fixer.
Top panel Republican Jim Jordan says Barr is fixing things, the Obama administration's political abuses.
Bill Barr is doing the Lord's work trying to clean it up so that it doesn't happen again.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
As of Tuesday, the United States had recorded its second largest rise in new coronavirus cases since the crisis began. There were more than 35,000 new cases reported Tuesday as dozens of states see a surge in infections. It comes as the Trump administration said Wednesday that it would no longer directly fund 13 of its original coronavirus testing sites in five states. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization says cases are rising globally. VOA Russian service reporter Anoush Avatishan recently spoke to Catherine O'Brien, WHO Director of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals via Skype. They discussed the importance of finding a vaccine.
We don't really have viruses that simply die out except for some of the coronaviruses that we've had before. Where they've circulated in only very small communities or small populations. They haven't been worldwide pathogens. So we're not really sure what's going to happen with this pathogen. And certainly all of the efforts that are being made to contain the pathogen, to make sure that it's circulating in only, you know, very small amounts, all of those efforts that are being done by countries to really constrain this pathogen mean that there's an ever greater chance that it's going to have less and less of an effect on populations. But that's totally dependent on the degree to which the interventions that we have already and the degree to which treatments, diagnostics, and vaccines can actually control the pandemic.
And what about the safety of the vaccine? Is it possible to develop safe vaccine in such short period of time?
In developing any vaccine, and certainly for COVID vaccine, there's going to be no compromising on the safety. The reason that we're able to go more quickly is, first of all, because there's a substantial amount of funding that's being put towards developing COVID vaccines. And so many more candidates are coming into clinical trials more quickly than ever before for vaccine development. And secondly, we're using the opportunity to, in fact, design clinical trials in new ways so that we move from one stage very quickly to the next stage. And in some ways, this is really driven by the interest of all countries to have a vaccine as quickly as possible. So the steps involved are really moving from one step right to the next step as quickly as possible. But this will not compromise, and there's no negotiating on the degree of safety assessment and on the rigor around safety assessments that are being done.
And how do we make sure that eventually everyone gets vaccine? Is there such a plan how to distribute vaccine and who will be first to get it? Is it like more younger people or opposite, people who are in risk groups?
So WHO is working very carefully on an allocation framework. And the allocation framework is really based on the principles of access. Access should be driven by public health goals. And what is required to achieve the end to this pandemic. And so an allocation framework that uses the evidence on the distribution of this virus around the world, the timing of the virus, and looks at who are the groups of people who are most at risk of the most severe outcomes. Death, of course, is probably the most important, and severe illness would be in that category also. So we're looking at very carefully at the data and at the evidence around which groups those are, which groups of people. And those would be the people that we would prioritize for vaccination, given that at the beginning of the development of vaccine and manufacturing of vaccine, there will be a limitation of supply. And as time goes on, the number of doses that are produced will increase substantially and greater numbers of people can be vaccinated. But we really should start from the principle of what will be needed in order to control the pandemic and eventually to end the pandemic. And I think what's clear from the evidence is that is unlikely to require immunizing everybody in every country. The ways in which the pandemic could be controlled through the use of the vaccine, along with diagnostics, treatment, and the kinds of public health measures that we've been using, which is to identify cases, understand who they've been in contact with, have people quarantine and be tested over a period of time when they might then develop signs or symptoms of the illness, and we can identify whether they've actually been infected.
Catherine O'Brien, WHO Director of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals. She was speaking to VOA Russian service reporter Anoush Avitstishan. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The United States Wednesday imposed sanctions on five Iranian ship captains who delivered oil to Venezuela, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo reaffirmed Washington's backing of Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido. Pompeo said the ships delivered about 1.5 million barrels of Iranian gasoline and related components, and he warned mariners against doing business with the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said Wednesday that Tehran would be open to talks with the United States if Washington apologizes for exiting a 2015 nuclear deal and compensating the country. But he cautioned that U.S. calls so far for discussions have been insincere. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he intends to impose Israeli sovereignty on more than 130 Jewish settlements, as laid out in President Donald Trump's deal of the century, the name of the U.S. administration's peace plan. Palestinians strongly oppose the plan, and while most Jewish settlers support it, some worry it could lead to a Palestinian state in the part of the West Bank that's not annexed. On Wednesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that the Israeli-Palestinian situation is facing a watershed moment over Israel's plan to annex parts of the West Bank. For VOA, Linda Gradstein reports from the West Bank settlement of Ifrat near Bethlehem, where opinions are divided.
Ifrat Mayor Oded Revivi is eagerly anticipating the annexation of his settlement, where 16,000 Israelis live next to the Palestinian town of Bethlehem. It's part of the Trump peace plan, which allows Israel to annex up to 30% of the West Bank. Yet there are still no maps showing specifically what will be included.
I think the Trump deal is a very big opportunity. An opportunity that we shouldn't miss, an opportunity that you don't know when and if will come about again, an opportunity that takes into account not only what we can get, but also the surrounding environment in which we are at the moment regarding the status of the Palestinian Authority.
Palestinians warn the annexation plan will lead to violence because they say it would make a Palestinian state impossible. For Revivi, the warnings make no difference.
They don't need an excuse in order to attack us or to kill us. So using this peace plan as a trigger to incite and to do another round of terror attacks, I'm not saying I'm undermining it, but I'm saying it's not a really relevant threat.
But some Ifrat residents believe annexation would be a strategic mistake. They say the move only serves the interests of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has been indicted on corruption charges.
I see the Prime Minister as willing to jeopardize Israel's relationship with Saudi Arabia, the peace treaty with Jordan, the burgeoning relationship with the Emirates, relationship with the Democratic Party in the United States, with Germany, France, just to stay out of prison.
Others in Ifrat look forward to living under Israeli law, saying it will have a positive effect on daily life.
There's a lot of day-to-day issues that haven't been taken care of properly, like safety on the road, different environmental issues, different legal issues, that because we live under a mishmash of Ottoman, British, Israeli military, Jordanian law, are not applied fairly in these areas. And so that's something we're very much looking forward to having.
Outside of Ifrat, some settlers have protested annexation for other reasons. They worry that the 70% of the West Bank that is not annexed under the U.S. plan will eventually become a Palestinian state.
I don't think the deal of the century is good for us. It includes a Palestinian state. We don't agree with that. I think it is time for the state of Israel to decide what its strategic sites are in terms of settlements in Judea and Samaria, and to take these decisions on its own. We know better than anyone what our strategic sites are.
Here in Ifrat, many say that the annexation will make it easier to build more new homes and will encourage more people to move here. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Ifrat, West Bank.
Can you imagine life being so dangerous that you would flee to Yemen for safety and opportunity? More than 250,000 refugees from Africa are now living in Yemen, and aid organizations say the dire needs of the general population, coupled with dwindling international resources due to the pandemic, have left almost nothing to support them. Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with Nasseh Shaker in Sana'a, Yemen.
Imagine living in a place so difficult and dangerous that you feel you have to flee to Yemen, one of the poorest countries in the world, embroiled in a brutal war and plagued with acute malnutrition and diseases like cholera. And then imagine this. As a refugee in Yemen, suddenly everything gets worse. This is Aya Mohammed Osman, a Somali refugee in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. She says since the pandemic began, her mother has been shut out of many of the homes she used to clean. When there is work, Osman says, she worries her mother will be exposed to the coronavirus. But when there is no work, she adds, there is also no food. Yemen has a relatively small number of reported COVID-19 cases, less than 1,000 as of June 23rd. But aid groups say the real number may already be far higher and growing. UNHCR representative in Yemen, Jean-Nicolas Bues, says protecting refugees in Yemen from the virus is nearly impossible.
The indication is that people have difficulties washing their hands regularly because they don't have access to running water. And it's, when they get water, it's not their priority to wash their hands. It's perhaps to cook or something else. The physical distancing is impossible. I mean, it's difficult in those overcrowded neighborhoods or overcrowded houses where different generations live all together.
Yemen hosts the second largest number of Somali refugees in the world after Kenya. And aid workers say the international funds to support some of them are being diverted to other emergency needs as the world's economy reels under the pandemic. The United Nations Refugee Agency says it may soon run out of cash and shelters for refugees and may have to fire about 1,500 local staff at a time when Yemenis are suffering financially. A widespread COVID-19 outbreak here would be disastrous, the organization says. Thousands of hospitals have been destroyed in the war, and there is a severe shortage of even the most basic medical equipment. Heather Murdock, VOA News in Istanbul, with Nasih Shaker in Sana'a.
A June 17th meeting between top diplomats from the U.S. and China was so low-key that no photos were released. Diplomatic sources say China asked for the meeting. It came at a time of heightened tension between the countries over a variety of issues. VOA's Steve Reddish has more.
Kung flu. U.S. criticism of China does not stop at its handling of the coronavirus outbreak.
The Chinese government's move against Hong Kong is the latest in a series of measures that are diminishing the city's long-standing and very proud status.
And President Trump has threatened to decouple the country's economic relationship as a new trade deal is stalled. A meeting in Hawaii on June 17th between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and China's top diplomat Yang Jiezhe resolved little. China called the talks constructive. The U.S. said China was not forthcoming and is waiting to see a reduction in what it terms China's aggressive behavior. 2 days after the meeting, Pompeo warned the Copenhagen Democracy Summit about China's intent.
It's pushing disinformation and malicious cyber campaigns to undermine our governments, to drive a wedge between the United States and Europe, and is saddling developing nations with debt dependency. We must take off the golden blinders of economic ties and see that the China challenge isn't just at the gates, it's in every capital, it's in every borough, it's in every province. Every investment from a Chinese state-owned enterprise should be viewed with suspicion.
Beijing accuses Pompeo of trying to drive a wedge between China and other nations.
Pompeo once again made groundless accusations against China in his video address, attempting to sow discord between China and other countries. China strongly opposes this. This U.S. politician's China-related remarks go against basic facts. It contributes to nothing but further exposes his deep-seated Cold War mentality and ideological prejudice.
From the South China Sea to the border with India, China's military muscle is making its presence known, a serious challenge for Washington, say analysts.
Because there are places, starting with Taiwan but extending elsewhere, where a increasingly powerful China is going to want to exercise its muscles. And we're going to have to find clever ways to push back, but hopefully in a way that resembles, you know, judo or wrestling more than boxing or more than, you know, sword fighting. In other words, pushing back, not winding up in violent encounters.
Nations now face a choice, says Pompeo.
I know that there's fear in Europe that the United States wants you to choose between us and China. But it's simply not the case. It's the Chinese Communist Party that's forcing this choice. The choice is between the United States, it's between freedom and tyranny.
Meantime, China and India have reportedly agreed to disengage from further confrontation after a border clash last week left 20 Indian soldiers dead. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
And the Rolling Stones gave fans a lockdown gift with the release of a new track that resonates with the pandemic and the lockdowns the world has been experiencing. Living in a ghost town, partly recorded during COVID-19 isolation, includes a video showing deserted streets and subway stations in London, Los Angeles, Kyoto, and other cities. The song Living in a Ghost Town was released on streaming and download services only. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Take care and be well.